This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Ronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, where you, me, top experts, and a big issue come together and create a synthesis of understanding. This is the last of three in our special podcast series, all on the same theme, the future of health. In the first, we've been exploring scientific advances in cancer, and in the episode after that, looking at what appears to be an epidemic of anxiety and depression. In this final one, the focus is on artificial intelligence, and we're asking to what extent AI could transform medicine. Machine learning is on the cusp of revolutionising our lives. Bigger, more powerful computers can crunch impossibly large amounts of data, analysing complex information just as accurately, so we're told, as the best specialists and at speeds humans can never achieve. From diagnosis to drug development, the potential advances that are claimed seem huge and exciting. But what's the reality? And how soon might we substantially benefit from it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is artificial intelligence or AI? With me in the briefing room is Madhumita Murger, who's the artificial intelligence editor at the Financial Times and author of Code-Dependent, Living in the Shadow of AI. Madhumita Murger, what is artificial intelligence?
So AI is a statistical software that can find patterns in large amounts of data. And now that data could be huge numbers of words, images, it could be video, audio, code, or even DNA, for example. But what AI does, or AI software, is it's trained on this data, so say books or the internet, and then it's able to find patterns that allows it to predict. So it can then predict the next word in a sentence or help to diagnose a disease or figure out whether somebody should get a loan or not.
Now, what examples would a listener encounter daily of AI in action?
So AI systems are sort of, in many ways, invisibly woven into our relationship with technology. So let's take social media, for example. If you've used Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube, the recommendations for what content that you should click on, or even the adverts that are targeted at you, that's all done through AI systems that sort of target you based on your profile or your demographic. Similarly, if you watch Netflix or listen to Spotify, you know, you get these recommendations of what you should watch next or what you might like to listen to. Those are determined through sort of predictive AI systems. But even more invisible than that, when you have applied for a mortgage or insurance, the price that you pay or whether you even get a mortgage, those sorts of decisions on the back end are facilitated by AI systems that look at your data and figure out what price you should pay based on your previous behaviours and experiences.
So we should be clear, shouldn't we? Because people talk about algorithms in a very kind of particular way. We've always used algorithms, haven't we? Because essentially they are bits of information that say if this, then that.
Yes. So an algorithm is essentially just a list of instructions, right? That's what it means. And as you say, in the early days of computers, it was a decision tree. It was if this happens, then this is what should come out the other end. And, you know, calculators are based on algorithms and so on. But what's different about these types of AI or machine learning systems, machine learning being a type of AI, is that It's predicting what is the most likely outcome for something. And so there isn't a definitive answer. It's not if this, then that. It's sort of guessing at what should come next based on what it's seen in the past. With these types of predictive or probabilistic systems, you might get a different answer every time because it's just sort of predicting the probability of an answer.
Now, explain to us how these new systems rely upon vast volumes of data that's fed into them and what difference that makes.
Yeah, I think if we all agree that AI systems are not human, they can't actually learn like people or children, then of course they have to be programmed and taught. And yes, to an extent, they are making predictions based on data, but they still need to have been shown huge amounts of data previously. So let's take ChatGPT, which people might have heard of. This is a chatbot that you can kind of ask it questions and it gives you answers in natural language. But for it to even know how to kind of generate sentences that make sense, it's been shown huge amounts of words, basically all of the text on the internet. And what it's done is learn to find the relationships between different words. And by doing that, it is then able to very powerfully predict what the next word should be in a sentence. And then the output has this very sophisticated feature of looking like it can write. There is still no understanding there.
So one of the things that we have to be careful about with AI is where its information comes from, how much information goes into it, and whether or not that information doesn't create mistakes and biases.
Exactly. So if you think about the fact that an AI system is trained on a specific data set, it will always reflect the data that it's trained on. So if there are errors in that data, it will reflect those. Or if there are specific biases. So let's take loans, for example. If a company has largely refused loans for a certain demographic, socioeconomic or racial or gender, or priced them differently based on if you're male or female driver, for example, that's what the AI system is going to learn, that males are more of a risky bet for car insurance, say, than women are, and then price those accordingly. And then that gets coded into the system, what we call kind of coded bias. So it's very important to look at what the weaknesses of the data that it's trained on, and then also to look out the other end to see, is it making those same mistakes and is it scaling those up?
Let's now apply what we've talked about to the realm of medicine. Looking at it from your point of expertise, what do you imagine would be the most useful ways we could utilize artificial intelligence in the field of medicine?
Yeah, I think this is kind of a unique and hugely life-saving potential that this has in healthcare and medicine. So if we think about the data that's used to train the system, you know, you would give it a whole set of medical data. So let's take breast cancer. Say you give it millions and millions of scans, you know, screens that people have undergone, and you label it saying these are the ones that turned out to be breast cancer, these turned out to be benign or nothing at all. And then you run the software on this. So it starts to learn, really looking at signs of breast cancer that may be invisible to the human eye even. And ultimately, now we're at a place where some of these systems are sort of superior to even some of the best human doctors at being able to spot early signs of a disease like breast cancer. So that's the potential and the objective. But of course, it has the same drawbacks we talked about around sort of if the data set isn't quite right, or if you have biases in how doctors have been labeling these things, or if you have entire populations not reflected in the data because they haven't accessed healthcare. You know, so these are all the socioeconomic issues that we need to consider. It's not as simple as just here's the data input and the output.
Madhumita Murja. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about record absences from schools, the one asking if we can meet the net zero challenge, and the one on the conflict in Sudan.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Right, back to artificial intelligence. And now I want to focus on how AI might be and is being used in medicine and whether it will transform healthcare. Mihaila van der Schaar is Professor of Machine Learning, Artificial Intelligence and Medicine at Cambridge University. And Piers Keane is Consultant Ophthalmologist at Moorfields Eye Hospital and a Professor of Artificial Medical Intelligence at UCL. Mihaila, if I can start with you. You're a computer scientist who develops AI systems for clinicians. Do you have any examples that you could give us?
I can give an example very recently from the area of lung cancer, where a young clinician here in the UK is very interested in trying to understand why deaths from lung cancer are actually very high compared to other countries. And in the process, he realized that in order for somebody to be given, for instance, an X-ray or a screening, 19 different variables are needed to make this type of recommendation that this person needs to be screened. And let's be honest, clinicians in the UK, and for that matter, nowhere, have time to collect these 19 different variables. So what we look together with him is, can AI reduce these 19 variables to only a few, in this case, only three, and achieve the same type of performance? So we were able to do that, and it's actually quite exciting.
Piers Keane, you're a consultant ophthalmologist, but you've also developed an AI system. What have you developed one to do?
So I specialize in the treatment of some of the commonest causes of blindness, like retinal disease, in particular things like age-related macular degeneration, which is by far the commonest cause of blindness in the UK. And so the reason that I got into artificial intelligence is because patients were facing delays in being seen and treated, and as a result, some patients were going blind. So I started to think about, could we use AI to look at a type of retinal scan? The retina is the nerve tissue that lines the back of the eye. Could we use an AI system applied on these retinal scans to identify those people with the most sight-threatening disease and get them seen within a few days rather than a few weeks or a few months?
So how did you go about it? Who did you work with?
So I decided to get in contact with industry. And I just remember that the co-founders of DeepMind were from London, two of them, and graduates of University College London, where I work. And I said, I'm a consultant at Moorfields. We're doing 1,000 retinal scans per day at Moorfields. Can we work together to develop an AI system to prevent blindness? And the rest is history.
Right. So you got together and worked with them. What is it that you actually came up with?
So we shared about 1 million anonymized historical scans with DeepMind and essentially trained these artificial intelligence algorithms to recognize different eye diseases. And then we were able to publish a paper a couple of years later showing the models were able to assess these scans and have a performance on par with world-leading experts from Moorfields for more than 50 different retinal diseases.
Right. So, Mihaila, looking at what Piers went through and looking at the process, how would we apply that to other areas?
Well, first, I think it's exciting not only for diagnosis. I think it's exciting for early diagnosis as well. Currently, patients may come to the doctor for various diseases when symptoms occur. Could we identify by using a variety of other information, including wearables, but also data from a visit to the GP with a particular non-specific symptom? So can we use this wealth of information that we are now acquiring to do early diagnosis? Because that can prevent a lot of disease. But I just wanted to say that AI can do a lot more. Can also increasingly help clinicians and patients to determine what treatments should be used, when, and for how long. And finally, as I mentioned, more the logistical side.
Would something like deciding who should be prioritized for organ transplants come into that category?
Oh, I'm happy you are saying that, because that's one of the very first topics that I worked when I started to work on AI. a clinician came that was working on heart transplants. And he was very interested to understand whether allocation of organs can be done better. And that is a very challenging topic, because if an organ is given to a particular individual, it means that the other patients that are on the waiting list are not going to get that organ. However, this particular organ may be better fitted to some people on the waiting list and not another. So what AI can do very nicely in this complex problem is identify what is the risk of the different patients to die in the foreseeable future. It can also identify whether a particular organ would lead to a better outcome to one individual than another, and also predict what will happen in the long run with this particular individual if it was transplanted with this specific organ. Due to the compatibility between the donor and the recipient, these different combinations are leading to very different outcomes. So we built actually an AI system to do heart transplantation allocation and show that actually this would lead to significantly better outcomes. And since then, we started to look in other areas like transplantation for lung or for kidney.
Pierce, you wanted to come in.
I just wanted to highlight one of the things that I'm most excited about that I think potentially could be super cool is a new field that's emerging that one of my friends has called oculomics, which is this idea of using the eye as a window to the rest of the body. So we as doctors have known for more than 100 years that you could pick up some signs of systemic disease from an eye examination. But what's been really exciting in the last 4 or 5 years is this idea that if you combine advanced retinal imaging, like the scans I was talking about, with big data, with the latest advances in AI, it turns out that you can actually potentially predict Parkinson's disease or dementia or predict risk of heart attack or stroke.
Let me get this absolutely straight. I go into Moorfields, I get a retinal scan, etc., because I think I've got an eye problem. And you may be able to tell me at the end of that process, actually, we've also uncovered that you may have a significant heart problem.
Yes. But the caveat to that is we're still at the proof of concept publishing research paper stage. So if someone listens to this recording and then they send me an email and say, can I come in and get diagnosed? I say, no, actually, it's a few years from now.
This seems a perfect time to bring in Jessica Morley, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the Digital Ethics Center at Yale University, to look at the challenges, frankly, and the ethical problems that AI in medicine can cause. Jessica, where are these AI systems, the ones that are actually making progress, where are they actually being used and how widespread are they?
Well, I think Piers has really just said it, that there is a problem that we call the implementation gap, or sometimes people refer to it as the model graveyard, where there is an enormous amount of work happening in the research field, in elite universities, in research groups inside hospitals. But the translation between what's being developed in a quote-unquote lab and then that being implemented on the front line and actually making a difference to patient care is quite significant, and the number of real-world use cases and therefore real-world evidence of effectiveness is actually relatively small.
Is it broadly the same everywhere? I mean, you're based in the US, but is that the picture not just in the US but everywhere?
Yes, it is pretty much the same everywhere. This is a sort of universal issue of there being challenges between research and real world.
It strikes anyone listening to people describe AI that the absolute key ingredient to AI is going to be data. And therefore, the quality of your AI is going to depend upon the volume and the quality of your data. How good is the NHS data system?
So often you will hear description that the NHS has the best data in the world because we have largely digitized records at a primary care level, and we have done since about 1996 for the vast majority of the population. And then we have very standardized image recognition data. The sort of caveat to that is that none of that data was ever collected for the purposes of research or the purposes of innovation. That data was collected for the purposes of managing direct care of the patient. And therefore, it's perfectly good for that type of use case. There are some problems that arise when you try to use it for secondary uses, i.e. the development of AI. For example, there might be pieces of information missing for a number of different reasons, whether that be because people don't want a particular piece of information to have been recorded. Ethnicity, for example, is missing in about a quarter of UK electronic health records, or is because the electronic systems in which the data is captured doesn't ask for that piece of information. There can be errors. For example, when the pandemic happened, there was a big story about a very healthy young man who got invited to be part of wave one in the vaccination rollout because in his record, his height had been recorded in centimetres, and so therefore his BMI was very high. Those are sort of errors in electronic health records that can cause problems in performance if we don't catch them. So it's very, very, very far from perfect, despite the fact that we do have records for a large numbers of the population.
Mihaila.
What I'm excited about AI is if you look at the cutting edge of AI of a few years back, a lot was building models. Nowadays, is AI to improve the quality of the data? So as Jessica said, there are errors in the data. There is missingness. But even more, often we cannot do AI because all of this information is not always harmonized, not always linked. And what increasingly AI is starting to do is to build AI techniques to deal with these imperfections of the data, the inaccuracies, the inequalities of the data, as well as harmonize and link data sets. And increasingly, I'm saying, let us use now AI to really deal with these various issues associated with data to improve the quality of the data and create better data.
Pierce.
I think we need to balance our excitement and our skepticism in this regard. Much of the NHS data is kind of gibberish. It's not really going to be very useful. On the other hand, there are some elements of NHS data that are amazing. And I think particular in my own area of imaging, high-dimensional imaging data. So at Moorfields, we have more ophthalmic imaging data than the top five centres in the US combined. And that's a pretty unusual situation to be in.
Now, so you've highlighted the problem of trying to make sure that the data you're capturing is actually really good data. And I imagine that also goes for the question, Jessica Morley, of bias in the data. We've just heard what might be left off patients' records and so on. And the obvious one which comes to mind is the idea that if your data set is predominantly about one particular sector of the population and misses out, let's say, a minority of the population, it may not be so relevant. So you may have created a complete treatment matrix for people whose needs are slightly different.
Yes, absolutely. There are very significant biases in terms of those demographic pieces of the population. There are also biases in the sense that healthcare data is only recorded if the person presents to the healthcare system. There are pockets of the population who have problems with accessing healthcare. They have problems in terms of trust, so they do not necessarily want to go to the formal healthcare system, and then those people are missing. So there are lots of these little bias problems that we need to be aware of before we start overly relying on these types of systems.
Let's talk about privacy, Jessica, because it seems to me that over the last few years, the major objection to the creation of AI models was the fact that anonymized data given to them might actually not stay anonymous. Can you take us through what the problem is there?
Yes, of course. So the problem is that when you are building any really big data model, you are having to pull in together, as we've already heard, multiple different points of data. You normally want maybe a person's full electronic health record, some data that is generated by wearables, or some data that has come from imaging. And when you pull together all of those different pieces of information, even if you have taken off, for example, a person's name and address and maybe even their NHS number, it becomes far easier to re-identify them because there are lots of points within that data set that when you add them all together are indicative of that only being one person. And that chances of that happening are higher when you have access to a greater proportion of the population. So if we are talking about having access to the whole country's electronic health records, plus these additional sets of data linked on, the risk of re-identifying becomes quite high. I'm not talking about people doing that nefariously. It is just a statistical fact. There is then also on top of that the fact that we are necessarily involving third parties, including private companies, in the development of these models. And that causes some issues to do with public trust, where people feel uncomfortable with the idea of their data being looked at by companies that are outside of the healthcare system. And so that's at the input level. There are also privacy risks that arrive at the output level, which is there are some chances that the models themselves, so the code, the algorithm that's producing the AI, is in itself disclosive because there are so many variables that are included in it.
So in other words, you can essentially do a kind of reverse engineering on the data. You can work it backwards. I want to move on to another ethical implication, and it came out of what you were talking about earlier, Mihaela, which is if we're going to use AI to do something like decide who gets a transplant or not, and you hinted at it, that means somebody's not going to, and they're not going to because the AI has decided it. Jessica, would we describe this as an ethical problem, or would we just describe this as a problem that clinicians have anyway?
Well, it's both. The slightly enhanced ethical issue that comes when you start using an algorithm is we don't necessarily always know what rules are being involved in that decision-making process, and we also don't know whether or not the public is comfortable with that idea.
Mihaela.
Yes, if the models that we are building are not transparent. However, increasingly, we are building a medical AI that is interpretable and truly transparent. So we could scrutinize, like we scrutinize humans making decisions, they need to describe the reasons why they have made one. The same we can do AI, and I think we need to impose that.
Jessica, what do you think of that?
I think it's part of the solution. When I'm saying how was that decision reached and us not necessarily knowing, it's also about the whole entire pipeline. And so I'm not being a naysayer, but we just need to be a little bit mindful of the limitations.
I suppose what I meant was, if Professor X denies you a heart because she's made that judgment, you know who to blame. If somebody turns around and says, computer says no, essentially, what are we to make of that in terms of accountability?
That's the real crutch of the issue. And that's what I mean about the whole pipeline being non-transparent. We don't know who you're going to hold accountable to. And that is a real problem because the whole pipeline of development is really extremely complicated. If we have come to the point where something, the algorithm is making a quote unquote wrong decision, where did the wrongness start? Is it who collected the data? Is it who curated it? So how did you decide what was cleaned and what was not? Is it the who designed the model? It was who evaluated the model? Is it who interpreted the model? We just don't know at the moment. And that is a real problem for the deployment of these types of models.
Piers, can we talk about now the barriers to adopting AI in healthcare, even where we think we've solved quite a lot of these problems?
So the way that I think of it, as in two different stages of developing and deploying these systems. So for me, one stage is going from an idea to an algorithm. That's when you publish your proof of concept in Nature or a top journal and you get all the kind of media attention. But then the next stage is going from code to clinic. And I used to very naively think that publishing in the top journal was the hard part, but I've come to realize that going from code to clinic is the hard part. And so why is that? Well, there's lots and lots of reasons. And I think most people would know that it's one thing to prove it works in a proof of concept on a sort of well-defined data set. It's a very different thing to prove that it's going to work in Grimsby or Liverpool or in Brazil or in different places around the world. So you need to have clinical validation. But you also, this is most likely going to be a medical device. So you need to have some regulatory clearance. And everybody knows that's going to cost a lot of money. But actually, those are kind of the known knowns. But the really kind of gnarly challenges are actually a little bit different from that. So suppose you have developed an AI system within your university or within the NHS or a combination of the two, and you're going to now try and commercialize that. Well, you're going to have to get your hospital and your university to agree to that and decide on the best plans. And that's not something that sometimes we're all that experienced in doing. So it takes a bit of time to do that right. But then you're going to have to think about, okay, do we need to set up a company? What's the business model? It's going to cost tens of millions or hundreds of millions to develop some of these things. And then once they're deployed, it's going to cost millions to maintain them. And somebody has to pay for it. So if you don't have a business model, well, guess what? it's not going to work.
In other words, it's going much slower than you hoped it would.
Well, I think it's because it's always hard to do things the first time. So the analogy I would use is we're in the 1870s. And the reason I say that is because 1882 was when Thomas Edison flipped a switch and his company lit up the Pearl Street district of Lower Manhattan. And that was the beginning of the electrical age. But for the decade before that, it was all these inventors getting prototype light bulbs. They would get a journalist into a room and they would say, here's my amazing light bulb. And then they would usher the journalist out of the room within a couple of minutes before the light bulb fizzled out. So what Edison realized is you need to have a longer acting light bulb, but also a reliable electricity generator. You have to have a connection system or grid. You have to have a meter so you can measure usage and have a business model. So it was a network of innovations that was needed.
Jessica, I imagine there are other barriers as well, which is that if you do have a system which does work, but it works in this very different way, people aren't used to dealing with these systems and don't necessarily know how to fit them into their culture.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of the sort of most significant barriers, because we don't necessarily know how to implement these things from end to end and into the clinician's workflow. So when is it the right time to provide input from an algorithm into the clinician's decision-making process, for example? And then there are also cultural challenges from the patient's perspective. How do you interpret things like informed consent in the context of using an algorithm? Do we tell patients that you have used an AI in their diagnosis, or do we not? They need to understand how it was validated and what are the potential risks or limitations of that algorithm, or do we not? So there are enormous amounts of challenges in that regard.
During the pandemic, we somehow or other managed to develop, test and get a vaccine out at a speed that we have never seen before. And I can imagine quite a lot of people looking forward and thinking, well, look, come on, guys. I mean, if you think this stuff can help, get it out there. But Jessica, you've identified other problems with what may happen if you actually do develop the thing at speed. In other words, before the system has the capacity to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the thing that I talk a lot about with image recognition. So if we take the example of breast cancer screening, if we know that there are really fantastic and they're graded as software as a medical device algorithms that are more than capable of recognizing breast cancer in a mammography scan, and we know that they are better at it in terms of picking up cancer earlier, but also picking up different types of cancer. But that's really at the very beginning of the pipeline. So we have drastically increased the capacity of the system to do diagnosis, but that doesn't mean that that increase in capacity has translated to the system's increase in capacity to treat those patients, because it's ultimately, it's not an algorithm that is doing a mastectomy or that is providing people with chemo. That's all still being done by humans and in hospital systems that have limitations on their capacity. And so there is a risk that if you dramatically accelerate the first part of the care pathway, that you are just shifting the backlog from point A to point B. And actually point B might be the harder point to deal with. And the concern that I have from an ethics perspective of that is that also causes psychological harm to the patient. If you are then giving an enormous number of people, say, a sort of ticking time bomb in their head that thinks, I am now at risk of cancer, or I am living with cancer, but actually the time period where they have that knowledge in their head and then getting access to the system is actually potentially exponentially larger than it would have been otherwise. That is a harm to the patient. So there are these complexities. That's why I talk about the whole pathway, not just the model or the algorithm in and of itself.
When we take all these things into account, the possibilities, the barriers, and we take into account some of the ethical challenges, taking a crystal ball out, where do you think we will get to on the medical use of AI in the next 10 to 15, 20 years?
I'm excited about first using AI not only to do diagnosis and to do treatment. I'm also excited about using AI to assist with healthcare systems. And for that, there are less ethical problems. So everybody is excited in building a next cure for cancer. But as one of my clinical collaborators said, we are saving many more lives if we are building an AI system that can help us triage patients better, understand when they need to be seen, how they need to be seen, how to allocate these clinical resources we have, where do we need to create capacity. So I'm very excited for the short term to use AI to improve healthcare systems. I'm also excited about using AI to better improve the quality of data. I'm also excited to enable learning from each other better. So we talked about different healthcare systems here, the UK, the US, other countries. There is an enormous opportunity to use AI to learn from each other. And then a lot of other things can happen in the longer run.
I absolutely get the possibilities, Pierce. The possibilities are significant. The barriers are not insignificant either. Where would we anticipate? I mean, I'm probably going to bow out by the time all of this sort of comes to fruition, but for our kids.
Well, so I'm 46 years old, I regret to say. And when I think 10 years from now or 20 years from now, I am optimistic. And I imagine the scenario where I'm like a senior consultant in the NHS. And at that point in the future, our IT infrastructure will have moved to the cloud. We'll have a lot of advances in privacy-protecting technologies, but we'll also have much more mature governance and ethical processes alongside those. So we can do studies getting insights from every person in the UK who's had diabetic eye disease or age-related macular degeneration. And so you can put that down as a prediction for me. That's what we're going to see in 10 years.
Jessica, I think you're the youngest of all of us in and around the studio. Are you hopeful about what AI might be able to do for your generation?
Yes, I tend to describe myself as being a skeptically optimistic. So I am very hopeful and very optimistic that these things will deliver enormous amounts of benefits. My skepticism comes from the fact that it's complicated to get it right. And we have to think about getting it right now so that the future is as bright as we hope it could be.
Are you at all worried that people are overhyping it?
Yes. I'm very worried that people are overhyping it, because I think there is a risk that if we overhype the potential of AI, we'll have such a gap between what people were hoping it was able to achieve. You know, we're thinking it can predict, we're thinking it can diagnose, we're thinking it can do all of these things. And then we will miss the opportunities for it to deliver benefits in a smaller way, which is some of the things that Mihaela was talking about in terms of really helping the system manage itself from a performance perspective and really think about patient experience as much as we think about actual clinical interventions.
So realism is important, but a sense of the possibilities is also very important. Pierce, how is the UK placed to benefit from the application of AI to medicine?
I mean, the listeners can probably tell I'm not originally from the UK. And the reason that I came here and the reason why I stay here is because I think it has the potential to be one of the best, if not the best in the world in this setting. Actually, we've got the NHS and we've talked about the pros and cons of the data, and we've got some of the best universities in the world. And what I would say, if I was in charge, I would like to see how we could try to get much more seamless access for people in our top universities to NHS data. And if we do that, if we solve that, then I think we could be a world leader.
That was Pierce Keane with Mihaela Bandishar and Jessica Morley. My thanks to them and to Madhumita Murja. My conclusion? I'm pretty excited about this, though mostly, it has to be said, for the next generation. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Rosamund Jones and Sally Abrahams. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was recorded and mixed by David Evans and Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.